word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Nearly 3 years have passed since four burlap-wrapped bodies were discovered among the dunes of Long Island's Gilgo Beach. Authorities were looking for a missing prostitute named Shannon Gilbert when they found the remains of Maureen Brainerd Barnes, Melissa Barthelemy, Amber Costello, and Megan Waterman, all sex trade workers. The investigation into their murders led to more bodies, now at least 10, believed by some to be victims of a single killer who was eluded capture for perhaps more than a decade. Robert Kolker is contributing editor for New York Magazine. His new book, Lost Girls, details the lives of the women who were killed, the heartbroken families they left behind, and the slow-moving police investigation into what remains an unsolved American mystery. Robert joins us from Argo Studios in New York City. Welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, so how about just an overview of the case? Many people have heard of it, but it's been some years.
Well, this is a still open case, an unsolved case involving a serial killer or perhaps more than one killer. And it all began with the discovery of four female bodies along Gilgo Beach, along Ocean Parkway, on the south shore of Long Island. These are four women in their 20s, all of whom advertised on Craigslist. They were found near one another and all wrapped in burlap. Now, the only reason they were found is because another woman who advertised on Craigslist had gone missing about 7 months earlier. Her name was Shannon Gilbert. Many people believe she's a fifth victim of this killer. And then, even more astonishingly, as the police continued to search for Shannon, they found six more sets of remains along Ocean Parkway, all within a few miles of one another. Some of them still have yet to be identified. Many people believe that it's all one killer who is still at large.
You set your prologue at Oak Beach. This is the small community on the eastern end of Jones Beach Island, where on May the 1st, 2010, Shannon Gilbert was knocking furiously at doors, saying that someone was chasing her, looking for help. Tell us what happened that evening.
Well, she was visiting a client, a John. His name was Joseph Brewer. And in the middle of the call, she ran from the house, afraid for her life. That alone was unusual, but what made it even more unusual is that she called 911 and stayed on the phone with 911 for 23 minutes. Anyone in the escort world would be surprised at this information because calling the police is something that escorts typically don't do. She pounded on doors and, you know, neighbors to varying degrees responded, but none of them were able to convince her to, you know, come in for shelter. And then she disappeared altogether. Now, this is a small community, a remote community. The media called it a millionaire's row. That's not exactly true. It's on state-owned land, so the people who live there aren't necessarily, you know, the wealthiest in the world, but they are there because they want to be left alone. And so it became probably the worst place to get into trouble because neighbors weren't really the most compassionate about the incident afterward.
But she's just one of five that are profiled in your book. In some cases, you go back more than a generation to show the victims of broken families where anxiety over money or custody battles or violence or sexual abuse are part of the family character and describe it in astounding detail. I was wondering about your investigative process while writing this book. Where did you get all these accounts?
I've often thought that the best crime stories are stories that lift the veil on a part of the world or a part of society that you don't know much about and that you really we all ought to know more about, ought to be paying more attention to. I'm thinking of books like The Corner by David Simon, Alex Kotlowitz's book There Are No Children Here, and Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc's book Random Family. As I got to know the families in this story for a cover story for New York Magazine, I started to learn more and more about the victims and their lives, and I realized that prostitution in America is changing. It's not just about walking down the street anymore, and it's not just involving people who might have already been social outcasts or disconnected from society. The internet has made it more anonymous and seemingly more safe. And so there are women out there and men who are taking part in prostitution who just wouldn't have done it a few years earlier. And that combined with harsh economic circumstances around the country means that prostitution is, you know, the face of it is changing. It's becoming somehow more professionalized and people are able to lead semi-functional lives while continuing to be escorts. I don't think anyone had really paid much attention to this, and this case sort of lifts the veil on that. So I thought, while obviously everyone wants an arrest in this case, and everybody wants to know who the killer is, it's equally important to learn about why these women became so vulnerable.
One thing common to these women, most of them raised in small-town America, or let's say gutted-town America, you know, once thriving places like Buffalo or Ellenville or Scarborough, Maine. Towns that were once thriving, now full of the dollar stores and the opportunities for jobs for these women is making $10 an hour at Bojangles or less at TJ Maxx. The lure of $800 a night as a stripper or an escort just kind of draws them in. But I'd love you to talk about the mechanics of how they use sites like Craigslist or Backpage to advertise themselves as escorts.
Well, putting an ad on Craigslist or Backpage couldn't be easier. You don't need a special computer. You don't need special software. All you need is access to the internet. And if you can upload a photo, so much the better. But you don't even need to upload a photo if you don't want to. And so within minutes, you can get an ad up there with your cell phone number on it. And then people start calling your cell phone. It's as simple as that. The people who take part in, you know, sex work online don't have any, you know, special setup going. All they need is a cell phone and access to the internet.
This is prostitution in the internet age and the new economy, but still the narrative around these women for certainly members of the Long Island Police Department or the Suffolk County Police Department and others who describe them, it sounds like we're looking at a Victorian era narrative of, you know, the prostitute as a fallen woman. The Long Island Police Department is a huge force, but they're not even going to assign a detective to a missing prostitute in one case. Another case, a family member goes to file a report on Shannon at Suffolk County, and the cops are concealing their laughter. So it's the vision of these women as something not worth being missed. Tell us about that.
Well, I write in the book that law enforcement really failed these women several times. They failed them when they chose this line of work and were at risk for falling into more problems, whether it was assault or murder or addiction. Failed them when they disappeared. Time after time in this book, you hear about how the families are concerned, but they can't get the police to pay attention. They failed them once this case became national news because they started to engage in victim blaming. Now, I don't say that to cast aspersions on law enforcement because I think that there's a need in our culture for easy answers whenever some big calamity happens. And in the case of a serial killer, it would be, you know, comforting to say, oh, well, they took the risks. They knew what they were doing. But I feel like this is a far more complicated case and a far more complicated issue. And these women were far more complicated than that gives them credit for. And I think when the police say something like that, they actually are walking away a little bit from the job at hand.
We're talking about the book Lost Girls, an Unsolved American Mystery with author Robert Kolker. It dives into the lives of five women who may be victims of the so-called Long Island serial killer, a case that remains unsolved. Bob, if you could please read for us a part of the book that leads into a very chilling aspect of the case. Melissa Barthelemy was 24 when she disappeared in July of 2009. You detail a passage of her family's final contact with her and what happened after she disappeared. First, any background you want to give us on this?
It so happens that the five women I write about in this book all came into escort work in slightly different ways. You know, one of them went straight to Craigslist, never considered being an escort before that. Another one worked with an escort service and then decided that she could make more money if she just went on Craigslist by herself. A third one got into it with her boyfriend, another one through her sister. But in the case of Melissa Barthelemy, she actually moved to New York from Buffalo and was a traditional streetwalker in Times Square for 2.5 years before she decided to abandon her pimp, who you'll hear about in this section. He's called Blaze. And so here we have her final moments we know about her. Melissa was seen alive that afternoon, July 12th, sitting on the curb outside her building on Underhill Avenue in the Bronx. Her phone records show a call to Blaze that evening, under a minute long. The next day, when Melissa stopped returning all calls and texts, Lynn and Jeff called off Amanda's trip. I'll say here that Lynn is Melissa's mother, and Jeff is Melissa's mother's boyfriend, and Amanda is Melissa's little sister. They called off Amanda's trip to New York and began calling local hospitals. Melissa's landlady got worried, too, when she heard the cats crying and scratching at the door. Lynn and Jeff tried to file a missing persons report, but for 3 days, the police deflected them. Only 10 days later would the police start a missing persons investigation. Only then would they subpoena Melissa's phone records, canvass the neighborhood, and pull a DNA sample from her toothbrush. That was when they learned that her phone record showed access to her voicemail on the night of her disappearance. The police might not have been stirred into action at all if, on the fourth day of Melissa's disappearance, July 16, 2009, Amanda's cell hadn't rung in Buffalo. When Melissa's little sister saw Melissa's number on the caller ID, Amanda rejoiced. Melissa? Instead of her sister's voice, she heard another. Controlled, comfortable, soft-spoken, male. Oh, this isn't Melissa.
Oh, chilling. Robert Kolker reading from his book Lost Girls, An Unsolved American Mystery. Bob Kolker, was this the killer? And has he made this kind of contact with other family members of victims?
This is a very unusual and obviously dramatic moment in this case because it seems to be the only moment that the killer has called up family members of the victims to taunt them. And he called several times and really traumatized Melissa's younger sister, Amanda.
Yeah, he revealed personal details about her. He knew that she was of mixed race, where she lived. Just terrifying.
Yes, it does seem clear that this is the guy. The police seem convinced of it. And in fact, these phone calls made the news a little bit in Buffalo during her disappearance back in 2009. And shortly after they made the news, he stopped calling. And nothing like that ever happened again. And then, of course, 18 months later, Melissa's body becomes one of those four that was found wrapped in burlap on Ocean Parkway in Long Island.
Now, this is the kind of thing that in police investigation, voice identification, location, in addition to finding a digital footprint of people who contacted these women via Craigslist or saw those ads in Craigslist, seem to me to be the details that would put together a credible investigation. Has law enforcement made a profile of the suspect?
They have in certain press conferences given a sense of who they think this is, but it's very general at this point. It's a middle-aged man who knows the area very well. What you say about a digital footprint is a very, very good point and a very interesting point because, you know, we live in this age where we watch CSI and we think that it should be a snap. And we actually see real-life examples where, you know, for instance, the Craigslist killer in the Boston area was found, what, in a day and a half? Because he, you know, there was a digital footprint. But I think his victim in that case is a little different from these women because these women were living slightly more off the grid. They were using burners. They were using disposable cell phones. Some of them were sharing phones with other people, you know, other escorts. And you can't exactly go on Craigslist and narrow things down by seeing who's looking in that category during that day because it's thousands of people. What seems like it should have been an open and shut case suddenly becomes a case where they're starting not just at square one, but they're starting late. They're starting behind because all these women had been gone for months and in some cases years.
The people who are guessing at what happened are the mothers and sisters of this victim that have formed what you call a grim sorority, a kind of support group that first convened only recently. You met with them at the Tribeca Hotel in Manhattan. What was this gathering like?
It was very emotional. This was early May of 2011, just a few months after those first bodies were found and when Shannon Gilbert was still missing and when the police were still searching out on Long Island. And the family members had started to get to know one another through Facebook and some on the phone, but this was their chance to meet each other in person. And this was the context for the magazine story I wrote about this case. And it was a very emotional day. Almost immediately, they started to speak a little shorthand with each other. They could talk about cell phones and they could talk about everything that had been on their mind, like how long it takes bodies to deteriorate when exposed to weather, you know, to the salt air out on the beach. They talked about their experiences with the police. They talked about their frustrations with the police and with the media. And then they talked about their lost daughters and sisters. And this is where it gets very, very complicated. I mean, there's a real tendency in this and in any other big media case to say that someone's an angel or someone's a devil, that someone's a good girl or someone's a bad girl, you know, whether it's Natalie Holloway or any one of these women in danger stories. But it's very complicated. These people had close relationships with these women. None of them were outcasts. None of them were thrown out of their houses and told never to come back. They all were in close touch. And yet it was difficult. It was tense. Most of them didn't like the fact that these women were doing this for a living. And yet to confront them about this would be to risk pushing them away further. And then it gets even more complicated still when you see that the women who are escorting are buying gifts for their family members and sending money back home. Now they have to wrestle with their own involvement in this decision. And yet they're not going to go quietly and say, well, we're to blame or the girls are to blame. Because there are a lot of people in high-risk professions who don't get blamed when something bad happens to them. These women chose to be escorts, but they certainly didn't choose to be murdered. And the families above all are upset about why these women were so vulnerable. And they were so vulnerable because the rest of us chose to ignore that they even existed.
Bob Kolker, you took such a deep dive into this unsolved mystery. I'm wondering if you have any theories about the murderer. Some say he could be in law enforcement, or maybe theories about what it would actually take to crack this case.
One question people have is whether Shannon Gilbert really is connected to the other cases. And while I'm not convinced that her disappearance is, it would be an amazing coincidence if she wasn't connected, that her disappearance would then lead to the discovery of the others. There would be no Long Island serial killer investigation if there weren't for Shannon Gilbert. So for that to be the case would be amazing. I am convinced that there are at least a handful of neighbors at Oak Beach that know more about Shannon's final moments. I also think that Joseph Brewer, her John, has not been forthcoming about what it is that might have set her off that night and made her so upset that she would call the police and go running. And as for the broader serial killer case, I don't necessarily think that the killer is law enforcement. This is an idea that came about because it's taking so long to find him and to discover who he is. They think, oh, this must be someone who's an expert in avoiding detection. I think the killer's an expert in avoiding detection because he's had such a head start. You know, these cases were cold by the time the bodies were discovered. A lot of serial killer cases wind up getting solved 5 or 10 or even 15 years later through a confession or through somebody getting pulled over. I am concerned that this might be one of those cases that takes that long to resolve.
Robert Kolker, author of Lost Girls, an Unsolved American Mystery. He's also an award-winning writer and contributing editor for New York Magazine. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Lost Girls was published in early July to superb reviews. You'll find links to read them and more on the unsolved case of the Long Island serial killer at wordofmouthradio.org. There's more word of mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us.